You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Is there something or someone in your life that you can point to and say, that single thing really shaped me as a person? That experience inspired the worldview or the passion that I've carried throughout my life? When you hear successful people talk about their lives, they often point to a formative thing that led them to do whatever it is that they accomplished, kind of like Steve Jobs and a calligraphy class that he sat in on at Reed College.
For our next guest, that thing is pretty common, something almost anyone could experience. It's a board game. It's chess. Eugene Brown was incarcerated in federal prison after a botched bank robbery. While behind bars, he learned to play the game of chess. In the process, he began to apply a lesson of that game to his own life. Think before you move. His story was turned into the movie Life of a King, starring Cuba Gooding Jr.
Anybody know how to play chess?
Everyone on the board is here for one reason and one reason only. To protect the king. In here and in life, you must think before you move.
Eugene went on to become a real estate agent and investor and now teaches at-risk kids how to play chess through his organization, the Big Chair Chess Club in Washington, D.C. He's in Wausau today and tomorrow speaking with high school students, and he'll talk at a public event at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow at the Center for Health Sciences at North Central Technical College. And he joins us now. Eugene, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm here.
Well, how were you first introduced to chess?
Well, chess came to me in Washington, D.C. one summer back probably in the early 60s, community-based program, Afrocentric-oriented, and one of the guys, Baba Mishore, he introduced chess to all of us. We just learned how to push the pieces, how to set the board up, and it really didn't have a real impact on me until years later.
And yet, Eugene, tell us how you rediscovered chess in prison.
Well, initially in 69, I was arrested in Paterson, New Jersey. Paterson, New Jersey in Passaic County is probably it is the same county that Harry Rubicane Carter came out of. And I was sent to Trenton State Prison. At the time, I was a fugitive from justice for a bank robbery charge, so that meant I had two cases pending. And I ended up getting sentenced in the state of New Jersey. And I was sent back to Washington, D.C. for extradition, and I got a 12-year sentence there. And so when I got back to Trenton State Prison, I was lucky because I'm a barber by trade. I learned barbering. That was my high school trade. And I was sort of like an elite prisoner in the state of New Jersey. My job used to be, I used to cut everyone's hair that used to come in. I met a lot of influential people, underworld people. But it gave me some liberties that other prisons didn't have. So that meant that I could go out to the yard twice. But chess as repeated bouts of being incarcerated as a youth, that was always one of the games that I gravitated towards because of I was an introvert. I never kind of lumped up with, you know, the gangs or anything like that. So as my chess experience grew, I kind of started following chess with the chesslers that they call themselves in Trenton. And that's where I kind of really got involved in the game. But the game really struck me. One day I was on an errand taking some books up to another wing, and I saw a brother in there with three boards set up in his cell. And you would have thought that he was a nuclear scientist. He had a book in one hand and three boards set up. And I was looking in his cell, and he kind of felt me, which probably was a violation, and it was. And he turned around. He said, "Can I help you?" So I said, "I'm just wondering, why do you have three boards set up?" Because in my mind, it was like maybe he had did too much time, you know, and I was kind of intrigued. So he said, "Well," he said, "the three boards are set up because I'm doing different variations of, and I'm opening and I'm expanding my opening repertoire." He said, "Do you play?" I said, "Yes." He says, "What opening do you use?" I said, "I just play." And he kind of laughed, like, you know. So he said, "Well," and he took me through a whole one-on-one chess experience that I never forgot. He explained the theology of chess. Hmm. He explained you know, what the advantage of white moving. A lot of people think it's racist. He said, but, you know, like, it's an offense and a defense. What, if you're playing the black side, you have to just struggle for the initiative. You know what the initiative is, don't you? So I said, well, not quite. And then he showed me, and this guy was just so, you know, the bars and the experience, he had transcended that whole prison experience into a whole learning experience. So he said, well, you know, after the end, he said, well, I'll see you on the yard, and if I get a chance, I'll go over some games with you. And but his thing was, that's how he kind of made his living. He gambled on the yard, and he saw me playing a game once, and he came over and kind of critiqued it. And he said, you know, you could have had him, he said, but, you know, you kind of went about it a long way, and you didn't want to lose a piece. But he kept giving me these type of insights into the game. And then he said, if you meet me in the chow hall later on, I'll give you a book on beginners.
We're talking right now with Eugene Brown, founder of the Big Chair Chess Club in Washington, D.C. He's in Wausau today and tomorrow, talking with children, at-risk kids, about how to use chess as sort of a roadmap for life. And I'm curious, listening to you talk, Eugene, what is it about chess in particular? What is it about this game that you think gives this kind of discipline and mental sharpness that maybe another game wouldn't give?
Well, one of the things I know from experience is the fact that it teaches you how to concentrate. And once you learn how to concentrate, I think that there's a whole lot of other doors that are open to you because, you know, the brain is just like any muscle, and the more you use it, the stronger it gets. And if you could sit down for 2 hours and play a game of chess, if you could sit down for an hour, 2 hours, you can take that same concentration package into any endeavor. So that's learning different techniques and strategies and having a plan. You know, I think somewhere they say life is but a dream, but chess has taught me that life is but a plan.
And your slogan in your efforts to teach kids has been think before you move. And it seems like chess is a really good way to learn that lesson. How are you seeing the kids you work with taking that lesson and living with it?
Well, through different modules that we try to employ into the think before you move, one of the things that's early learned in chess is that if you touch a piece, you have to move a piece. And that teaches you that even before you move that piece, you have to know where you're going. And it started giving you a visualization as to how this board is going to look maybe 3 or 4 moves down the line. And on my way in, I was getting a piece of candy out of a jar. And the first thing I told the announcer here was that, I said, you know, this is where chess starts. He said, well, what do you mean? So as I went into the jar, I looked back over one shoulder, and I looked back over the other shoulder, like a kid going in a cookie jar. I said, that's one of the first experiences I know in playing chess.
And how did it end up changing your life once you had locked down some of those lessons of discipline and thinking before you moved?
Well, I think the greatest concept that I've learned that really turned the corner in my life was the fact that I had always blamed people for the position that I was in. And the guy that taught me, his name was Massey. We call him the chess man. What he taught me was a life-changing experience. He taught me that he almost grabbed, put his arm around me and looked right at me, held the king in his hand. He said, you know, you're the king. You're the one that's responsible for every move that's made on your side of the board. You can't blame anyone for anything that happens on your side of the board. All of these pieces look for you to give them a job. And until you accept your kingship, you're always going to be a follower.
We're talking to Eugene Brown, founder of the Big Chair Chess Club in Washington, D.C. His story of using chess to turn his life around after years in prison inspired the movie Life of a King. He's in Wausau today and tomorrow.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have any questions for Eugene Brown? Do you play chess? Is it something that resonates with you about the life lessons that chess can teach you? Or maybe something else in your life that served as an inspiration like chess did for Eugene Brown? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Eugene Brown. He's the founder of the Big Chair Chess Club in Washington, D.C. His story of using chess to turn his life around after years in prison inspired the movie Life of a King. And he's in Wausau today and tomorrow.
He'll be talking about his story and about his efforts to teach kids how to play chess, to teach them to think before they move in the game and in life. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for Eugene Brown? Is there something in your life, maybe chess, maybe a hobby, maybe a mentor that served as an inspiration like chess did for him? Have you taught chess to kids? What do you see them getting out of it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Eugene, let's talk about teaching chess to kids who've maybe never played the game before. It's a tough game, can be an unforgiving game. What are the kids' first reactions when you're teaching them chess?
Well, you know, in chess and in life, there's three stages. There's the opening, there's the middle, and the end. When I teach chess, I always teach the opening game and how important it is to develop your pieces. And in life, your opening game is how important it is to develop your skills. So the way that I always go about setting up the chessboard is a very unique way that I explain it. The king lives in a castle, and I identify the castle. Who works in front of the castle? The pawns. Who rides around the castles all day? The horses. Who rides on the horses? The knights. Who's the closest to the king and queen? The bishops. Why are the bishops the closest to the queen and king and queen? Because the bishops give the king and king, queen spiritual advice. Who's the only thing that's left? And with that, they learn how to set the board up and learn the pieces. So the game from there, we just implement piece after piece. We learn how the pawn moves, how the rooks, the castle moves, how the knights move. And they don't learn chess until later on. They learn how to take pieces at an early stage, and then they learn how to play chess later. And so the first concept is learning the opening game. How is the opening game related to your life? And, you know, if they just walk away from our club learning how to play chess and saying, I beat him, he beat me, we've missed our whole mission. Our whole mission is to be able to take this game off the board and to apply it into your everyday life. So chess have also taught me how to negotiate, because most of the moves on the board is a negotiation, you know. And how do you win in negotiating? You have to give something to give a little back. You have to give this, you know, and a lot of times it's a sacrifice. And sacrifices don't always mean that you're losing. Sacrifice actually is a gain. So they're learning a life skill as they learn chess from the way that is taught from the Big Chair Chess Club.
Can you tell us about one or two of the kids that you've worked with and how chess maybe changed the course that they were on and the way they thought about the world?
Sure. You're talking about kids that in Washington, D.C. that came out of public housing, that were surrounded with elements that was conducive for failure. And for them to come out of that environment, and I came out of almost the same type of environment, so the commonality of experience, you know, have been a big help to me to be able to identify that it's just a matter of being able to change the paradigm, being able to change that self-image. And a lot of that self-image is changed on the chessboard when they see that they can achieve something that they thought they never could do. Playing chess was maybe like for a nerd, and for them to sit there and beat a guy that they thought was smarter than them simply because they knew how to play the game. And knowing how to play the game is so important, because anything that you do, you have to learn how to play the game. So It's like life, you know. Chess. I teach chess is the only game that can't be won. It can only be played. Life is the only game that you can't win. Life, you just play it. What is it? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So you're never winning in life.
Is there pushback from kids at first? Like you said, they might think of this as the smart kid's game or the nerd's game. Is it tough sometimes to just get them to sit at the table in the first place?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of them, I've even heard them say, well, I don't have time for this. I don't have time for that. And my pat answer has been, you got time to make a mistake. And so some of those things that end up catching their ear is the fact that, you know, you learn it on the board or you can learn it in the street. And most of what you learn in the street is miseducation. I tell a kid today, and I just left a group of kids, and I saw them when I asked them about some of their occupations that they wish they had or some of the things that they could do looking at their end game. And they asked me, well, what would be your, what do you wish you had? I said, I wish I had been a drug seller. They said, I don't believe that. I said, yeah. I said, I could have been a pharmacist and sold drugs all my life. That's what pharmacists do. But they never heard it from that vernacular and looking at it from a different angle, and it's the same on the chessboard. You think you being in a tough position, and you may be in a winning position. And it's just a matter of how you look at things, how you look at yourself. Your self-concept determines. So learning this game or learning any other game, you're going to have to use the same principles, because principles don't change. And you're going to find out that if you don't know how to play the game, someone else will be playing you. So that's always good ear, because this is almost the language that they hear on a regular basis. This is the language of the streets. You know, this is their lingo. So I've been able to connect because I know a lot of it, and I know if it was able to turn me around, I know the power of the game. You know, and being able to articulate my experiences, because I think that's what a teacher has the ability to do, to facilitate conscious thought and be able to entertain people with the spoken words. So I know I've been gifted to be able to translate you making mistakes out of impulsive moves. I have a program right now in Raleigh, North Carolina, on death row, and the death row chess players have been able to say, and they've actually woke me up to the strength of this game. They say anytime I can sit 3-4 hours in a chess game and forget all that's going on around me, this is a powerful game.
Yeah, that is something about chess. It can be incredibly time-consuming. It's you and somebody else sometimes just staring at a board in silence for a really long time. Do you ever think of it as a kind of meditation?
Yes. You said a key word, and you know, one of the techniques I use, if I'm in a classroom, 10 minutes before we start is complete silence. And the complete silence is if anyone breaks the silence, they have to step out the room because we identify that person as the weakest link. And we'll sit there, no one makes a sound, and I use that technique to quiet the mind down, and that is meditation. 10 minutes just before the closing of the session, the board's up, and we go back through the silence. So I've been able to use that because I know once the mind has been quiet, this is a teaching moment.
Talking to Eugene Brown, founder of the Big Chair Chess Club in Washington, D.C., in Wausau, to talk about the value of chess. So teaching kids, you've done that, Eugene. You've taken this to death row. What's next? How do you want to expand your love of the game and bring it to more people?
Well, I was in an ABC Up Close interview. Actually, this is where the movie was spawned from, ABC Up Close in 2002. And at the end of the interview, they asked me about my end game. They said, well, what's your end game? I said, I have a chess club like this in every major city across country. And I didn't even realize I had said that. And a lady in Bakersfield, California, that had a chess program, she's kind of taking me up on that. So now I have a Big Chair Chess Club in Bakersfield, California. Matter of fact, 10 of those kids came to Washington, D.C. November the 22nd, And we were invited to the Cosmos Club there, which is a very ritzy club on Embassy Row. And that was quite an experience. And I think alternative education, I think this is an ideal, because I was teaching chess in Catawba County at an alternative school. And for some kids, I stayed there 2 years, and kids that were very disruptive, behavior problem, we were able to send five of those kids back to their regular high school, and they graduated with honor. And those kids, three of them now went to the military, and two of them are in college right now.
That's a great place to leave it. That was Eugene Brown, founder of the Big Chair Chess Club in Wausau. Now he's speaking at a public event at 6:30 tomorrow in Wausau at North Central Technical College. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Just a couple decades ago, if you went looking for grains at the grocery store, you'd find rice, oats, and that's probably about it. But today there are so many healthy and wonderful grains available, and you don't have to go to a specialty store to find them.
Our guest now on Food Friday is hoping that with a little info and some great recipes to try, these grains will find themselves on all our tables.
Terry Milligan joins us now. She's a chef, culinary instructor, and food writer, and she teaches classes at various locations around the state, including the Milwaukee Public Market. She frequently writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel food section and has a featured quarterly article in the food magazine Edible Door. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So when we talk about whole grains, what falls under that category?
Well, a whole grain is actually a grain that's in its natural state. It has to have three components, which would be the bran, the germ, and the endosperm. So you have to have all three of those, and that makes a whole grain. And what happens a lot is some of these grains don't have the bran and the germ in with them, and then you lose 25% of the grain's protein value. So that's why you want to look for something that says a whole grain. It doesn't have to be like a whole big grain. It could be ground and still be a whole grain. It just means they ground up all three of those pieces of the grain. So that's why you look for whole grains.
And for the purposes of our conversation, and I think the way a lot of people cook, we're going to talk about some things that we cook like grains, we serve like grains. They're not technically grains, right?
They're kind of pseudo-grains, we call them. So, you know, people think of them as grains. So let me say wild rice. People think of wild rice as a grain. It's really an aquatic grass. So that's why you see the pictures of Indians harvesting the wild rice and they're canoeing, because it's an seed of an aquatic grass. So there's some of those that people just throw into the grain category when technically they're not really grains. But I just like to see people eat whole foods like that, so I let them get away with it.
So is there evidence that these whole grains are kind of picking up in popularity these days?
Oh, I think there's definite evidence with that. I mean, you can see it everywhere from magazines that probably never would have had anything about kamut in it, 12, 10, 5 years ago. And now you're seeing those types of things coming up. Now, not everybody knows what it is, and that's why I'm here to talk to you. But there are lots of those whole grains coming into the mainstream that you're hearing about.
Yeah, let's name some more names. You mentioned kamut. What are some of the other interesting grains or grain-like plants that we should maybe try cooking with?
Well, one of the best that has a lot of nutritional value is wheat berry, because that is the berry, the entire wheat kernel except the hull. So it's all three of those things I talked about, but it's not ground down. So it becomes, once it's cooked, and they do take a little longer to cook some of these whole grains, but it's a nice kind of chewy texture. So for those of us who might be wanting to substitute some of these grains for meat and poultry and, you know, being more vegetarian in your diet, it gives you that kind of chew that you're looking for. So wheat berry is a great one. Another one of my favorites is farro. And farro is something that, again, is coming into the mainstream a little bit more, originated in the Fertile Crescent over in what really is kind of that Egypt, Syrian, Lebanon area. But it is a grain that you're seeing a lot more of.
I recently decided to try out a recipe I just happened across. It was for a farro salad. It had some cheese and some apple cider in the broth. It was really yummy, but
I had to do a little bit of wandering around my grocery store aisles to find it. I did find it, but how available are these grains?
It kind of depends on your grocery store. Sometimes you'll find these grains in with the cereal section. Sometimes I find that they're over in the more kind of the health food, so to speak, area. So you do have to do a little bit of investigative work, I guess I'd call it. But the other nice thing is if you're in a larger area, such as a Milwaukee or Madison, there's lots of grocery stores or stores that are co-ops maybe that would be focusing on those types of grains, and you can find them actually in the big bin format, so you can buy just what you need and you don't have to store more than you need.
Let's talk about cooking with some of these different grains. I'm sure it varies from grain to grain, but as far as function on our plate, what kind of things can we substitute in these different kinds of grains for?
Well, you can easily substitute them as a main course. The farro we talked about for a minute is great as a risotto. So instead of using the arborio rice, I use farro and add some sweet corn and some shiitake mushrooms, and it becomes kind of the same type of thing that you would do with an arborio rice, where you add some liquid a little bit at a time. You do the same thing with the farro. It becomes a little creamy, and it's a nice thing that you could have just as an entree or serve it with a protein like a grilled fish or grilled chicken. So that's a nice way to add some grains to your diet. Salads, you also mentioned, and any of these grains work great in salads. And you also can use them in things for your breakfast items. Expand your oatmeal and add a few of these other grains like quinoa and amaranth in with it.
We're talking to Terry Milligan about expanding our grain horizons, things like farro, quinoa, amaranth, millet, and lots more. By the way, we've got a recipe, which she was just talking about there, to cook with farro. It is farro risotto with corn and wild mushrooms that Terry provided us. Again, that's over on the Central Time Facebook page. You can try it out this weekend.
And let's talk a little bit about that recipe, Terry. I've made homemade risotto before, and I love it, but I don't like the part where I'm standing at my stove and I'm stirring it for an hour. Do you have to do the same thing with the farro, or does
it
come together differently?
Well, there is some stirring involved. It takes a little less stirring. It's about 25 to 30 minutes total cooking time to make. But I always think that you can be in the kitchen, but you don't have to be constantly stirring. Just kind of keep an eye on it. When that stock is absorbed, add a little bit more. But it's not kind of the same stirring forever as the traditional risotto made with arborio rice.
So how else does that one come together, and how does it taste when it's done compared to a traditional risotto?
Well, the farro, to me, gives it an earthy flavor, especially when we add the wild mushrooms to it. So the creaminess, it's not as creamy as the arborio rice. That rice is specific to risotto because it does exude kind of that creamy texture from the starch. So this won't be quite as creamy, but there is a little creaminess to it. But it does have a bigger chew to it. And as I said, that really kind of earthy flavor.
Now, Terry, sometimes I want my grains to be hearty and earthy and maybe chewy. And then sometimes I don't. Sometimes I want something on a par with white rice to go with something, maybe a stir fry on top of it. Are there some alternatives that might have a little more nutritional value than that white rice that still have a light feel to them?
Well, I think quinoa is a great one that has a lighter feel. And most people, that's a grain that they are more familiar with because it was one of the first grains that came around into the cooking world that became a little bit more mainstream. The other nice thing with quinoa is it cooks very fast, so you can cook some quinoa in probably 10 minutes, and it's also gluten-free. So you get a little bit more texture probably than a rice, but a lot more of your nutritional value than you would with just a white rice in particular.
Yeah, quinoa, it's all over the place these days. Some people are talking about it as a superfood. What is the nutritional breakdown in quinoa?
Oh, I knew you'd ask me that. I don't know.
It's just very good for you.
It's called the superfood because it has all 9 of the essential amino acids in it. So that's why they call it the superfood. I don't know the exact breakdown on the top of my head, but that is why the superfood kind of name has come with quinoa.
And it is high in protein, right?
Oh, it's extremely high in protein, and it's also available now in a lot of different colors. So you can get black quinoa and red quinoa, the traditional kind of white quinoa. Some of them cook, the darker colors take just a tad longer to cook, but all are very nutritious. Now, that is actually a seed. So that's one of our pseudo-grains.
We're talking about grains and pseudo-grains today with Chef Terry Milligan. She's helping us expand our horizons, and we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite whole grain that you cook with? How did you discover it? How do you prepare it? Do you have a question about how to work with it? Maybe you tried it and went wrong, but you want to try it again. Terry might have some advice for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post and find some recipes over at the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll be back with Terry and with your questions soon. And right now, a few headlines we're keeping an eye on with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Chef Terry Milligan about using whole grains in our cooking. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you interested in whole grains but not sure where to start? Or have you started your foray into cooking with these grains and pseudo-grains? What kinds of experiences have you had? Good stuff coming out of your kitchen, let us know. And if you have questions about which grains will work well when you need to be able to make a fast, healthy meal, let us know that, too. Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And at the Facebook page, we have a couple recipes. We mentioned already the farro risotto with corn and wild mushrooms. Now, Terry, we've also got, you sent us wheat berry and wild rice salad stuffed winter squash. I love squash. I love the idea of stuffed squash. Talk us through this recipe.
Well, I can not only talk you through the recipe, I have a video on that recipe, too. So you can go on my website and actually see me make it. So that helps listeners actually see how to work with the grains as well. But with this, I always like to have an edible receptacle if I can. So in this case, it's an acorn squash. So I used acorn squash. I picked two different grains. It's up to you what you like, but I did the wheat berry. Sometimes I use kamut, which I talked about before, kind of a chewy grain. And I used wild rice. And then I added some steamed sweet potatoes, some dried fruit. I used Door County cherries because that's where I'm from in Door County, but you can use whatever dried fruit you want. So kind of toss that together to create a salad, put it in some steamed squash, and just pop it back in the oven, and you have a whole meal in an edible receptacle.
I was trying to bring to mind wheat berries. You said they're a little chewier. So what is the cooking process like on those guys?
Well, wheat berries are some of these grains that are true whole grains do benefit from a soak. So that's one that some people will soak overnight or for a couple of hours in cold water just to kind of soften it up. But berries such as wheat berries, which have all three of the components of a grain still intact, do take about an hour to cook. So basically, you're just simmering them in water on the stove with enough water. If the water goes down a little, you just add a little bit more kind of hot water from a kettle until those berries, those wheat berries are firm, but you can bite them like an al dente kind of pasta, firm to the touch but cooked through. So those types of berries do take a little bit longer than something like a quinoa, which is the seed that takes just a few 10, 15 minutes.
We had a caller, Mary, who called into us at 800-642-1234. I couldn't stay on, but she says she wants to get into, doesn't know that she wants to get into these fancy rices and grains. So she's wondering if she could just cook some white rice, but maybe put some ground flax seeds in the mix to give a little more nutrition. How do you think that might work out, Terry?
Well, I think that would work well. Flax seed is one of those items that does benefit, and she said ground, and that's how you really want to see those flax seeds, ground. That's how you're going to be able to absorb more of the nutrition from the flax seed. So I think that would work out nicely for her.
But do you want to give her a little pep talk to try some of those fancy rices and grains? Because that's what you're shooting for here.
I think she should move away. She can go start just if she wants to stay in the rice realm. Try something like a red Himalaya rice, which is going to have some more nutritional value, but still in the rice category. So you're going to cook it like a rice, and you could add that even to the white rice. So you kind of meld it into your diet. But that red Himalaya rice is very easy to find. There's also a black rice that's around. a little bit more for the more adventurous. I think she's more on, let's just get her into a few of these.
Well, I am big time into soups right now. What do you recommend for a grain that might make a nice sub out for rice in a soup?
Well, again, for a rice in the soup, I would go for something like the Himalaya, which is a little chewier. For grains in a soup, again, I'd go for one of those chewier grains, and that's because you're going to be heating and simmering the soup. If you put something like a quinoa in a soup, it's very tender, and if you cook it too long, it's going to break down. You could add it right at the end. But something like a bulgur or the kamut, the wheat berry, farro, you've talked about that. That would be a great one for the soup. So those hold up well for a simmering type of a meal.
How about barley? I used to like barley, haven't tried cooking with it in a good long time. If I want to experiment, what would be a good thing to try out with some barley?
Well, barley's great in soup, too, and stews. So those are two things that you could use your barley for. Again, it's a heartier soup, a heartier grain. It does contain gluten, but it's lower in gluten than a lot of the other grains. So for those of you who have to watch that a little bit, the barley, though, again, has gluten, a little lower in the gluten content. Barley, even in a mix with the rice, would be nice.
We're talking with Chef Terry Milligan right now. She's got some ideas about how to cook and start enjoying whole grains in our kitchens and our lives. And Terry, I want to ask you about protein. A lot of people are trying to cut down a little bit on meat these days. Are these whole grains, some of them you mentioned quinoa, that are kind of packing a bigger punch for protein? Is that a good way to go if you want to cut down on meat? Can you sub in some of these grains?
Well, definitely a lot of the grains have a lot of protein. You mentioned quinoa. Amaranth is also a very high in protein grain. And that's, again, kind of a pseudo-grain. It's a seed and very small, but it's easy to add to things like if you're making, if you are a mom and you want to make your own granola bars, adding a little of that amaranth is in there is a great way to add some protein, magnesium, some antioxidants. So those are two that are really great with the proteins.
I wanted to ask you and maybe see if you can convert me on something, Terry. I once tried cooking with millet. And I'll say I used to work a long time ago at a store that sold bird seed. And when I ate the millet, I thought, yeah, I'm eating warmed up bird seed here. This is really unexciting. What's a good way to eat
well,
some millet?
That's funny because when I used to own a restaurant, and about 15 years ago I made something for the restaurant, a burger, a vegetable burger, and used millet. And my I was the only woman. All my male chefs were always kidded me about the bird seed in the So it is, and it is actually dates back. It's one of our oldest seeds. It is gluten free, but it dates back to West Asia about 10,000 years ago, and it is a staple in African, Indian, and China diets, and very high in zinc and vitamin B. But it is used in the West as you said as bird food a lot. But it is very quick cooking, so I think it's just a matter of adding it to something else. I don't think it's something that you're going to be sitting around eating a bowl of millet. But you could add that even into things to get some more nutrition into even a meatloaf. Add a few grains into the meatloaf. Get the kids to get some of those grains, but they don't really know they're getting them because it's mixed in with meatloaf or meatballs.
Can you do anything kind of desserty and fun? Is if you really want to get distance yourself from the whole bird seed metaphor, can you do kind of decadent things with grains at all?
Well, you can definitely do things with quinoa and make like a what we would refer to as a rice pudding, but using some of these grains, like a more of a quick cooking grain like a quinoa. Cornmeal is considered a grain, and there's a lot of things you can do with that. I am doing something for a little get-together for Edible Door magazine in a couple of days, and I made a cornmeal cake made with olive oil and rosemary, but it's a dessert cake. I threw a little Grand Marnier in it, too.
Sounds pretty good.
Because it is the holidays. But you can definitely use those whole grains, like the cornmeal and something like that.
As far as combinations go, too, I know in that wheat berry and wild rice salad that we put in winter squash, I think you've got some nuts and fruit in this mixture. It seems like a lot of these grains are things that would go well with various kinds of nuts, maybe dried fruits.
Dried fruits go great because you get that sweetness to go with it, too. So that's a nice addition. I have on my website a tabbouleh salad that uses traditional bulgur, adds the quinoa, but then I roasted eggplant to put in with it, too. So kind of adding a little bit more dimension to a traditional preparation.
Now, one of our callers used the word fancy when describing these grains. Is that fair, and do they cost more than the other ones?
Again, it depends on the grain. I find that some of them are very reasonable. I just went to our Whole Foods store here in Door County and got some kamut, and it was less than $3 for a pound. But then if you go and try to find quinoa, it's gone very expensive. One of the reasons for quinoa being expensive is that it is a seed that grows in a high elevation, and it's hard to grow. And the other thing is it is very being used a lot. So you're finding some of these grains like that being a little bit more expensive. But I think things like the bulgur, barley, cornmeal, things like that are certainly in the price range that people can afford.
Well, Terry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
That was Chef Terry Milligan sharing her ideas with us about how to cook and enjoy whole grains. Her recipes for farro risotto with corn and wild mushrooms and wheat berry and wild rice salad stuffed winter squash. You can find all of those on the Central Time Facebook page.